Thanks very much. Let's give him a round.
All right. Thanks very much. I must say, just to lead in, that I sat through the last presentation and I can pretty confidently add another thing to the list that lawyers don't understand about software. They really wouldn't get asynchronous I.O. So just in case that doesn't give it away, I am a lawyer. I've got the law degree to prove it, and I've nearly got the PhD to prove it as well. But on the other hand, I'm not a lawyer. I have a degree in engineering, and I still work as a web programmer, mostly in Python, and mostly on the wonderful open source product Plone. So I was going to make some joke about how at nights I get out my Python and go deeper and deeper into indentation, but I didn't think that was the sort of thing that I should say at a conference which is being recorded. I promised in my abstract that I would reduce my 80,000-word thesis argument to 7 words for you, and I've had a bit of fun doing that. It's always good to be able to boil down your message to, you know, an elevator pitch. But so I've had a few different versions, but this is the version that I think best describes where I'm up to at the moment. Basically, I'm saying that software and mathematics are fundamentally identical, and I'll talk about that a little bit in this talk. And as a result, mathematics is unpatentable, always has been unpatentable. Another interesting side issue is no one knows why, or at least in the most recent case I could find, no lawyer could find any authority for the proposition that mathematics is unpatentable, right, in a case in the UK. But the reason that I believe that mathematics is unpatentable is that for mathematics to advance, it depends on freedom. It depends on free access to the existing state of knowledge of mathematics. And I guess I should say, if there are any questions at any point throughout, feel free to interrupt, because the longest talk I've given in the last 12 months is about 15 minutes, and the shortest is about 90 seconds, so it may be that I run under time a little bit. Okay, so now that I've told you where I'm coming from, we can start with my proposition that lawyers don't understand software. Now, obviously, as I said... I'm a lawyer, so this isn't intended to be a lawyer bashing exercise, although, you know, there may be an appropriate forum for that. You could have a boff for that if you wanted, perhaps, but don't expect me to be there. Basically, I've gone through various stages with this PhD, and the first stage was anger. Why the hell do they continue to get this wrong? I can't believe it. It's so simple. Why do courts and legal academics continue to get the issue wrong? But I've moved on past that, and I've come to the realisation that really they're trying to do the best that they can with what they understand. Being a patent court judge is a pretty difficult project, you know. You go from biomedical engineering case 1 week to a software case the next, and so on and so on. So they have to kind of get their heads around very technical areas in a very technical area of law. And it's almost inevitable that they're going to make mistakes. So after 4 years of reading all the various cases, I've come up with 7 things that I think that they could improve on. So it's a bit of a report card for lawyers. But one thing you might need to keep in mind is that your mileage will vary depending on who the lawyer is you're talking about. Some lawyers get it, some lawyers don't. You know, so if you're talking about Eben Moglen, obviously he gets it a lot better than Perry Mason. Not only because Perry Mason's a fictional entity. Okay, so we'll start through the top 7. A couple of differences between Dave Letterman and I. I can think of a few more differences between Dave Letterman and I, but they're not in any particular order. The order's arbitrary, but I think as they kind of go on, you get a sense of all the things that I've looked at in my thesis. Okay, so the first one. The relationship between software and mathematics. Well, as I said at the start, I think software really is mathematics. That they're fairly much, that software is a mathematical, writing software is a mathematical task. There's a few reasons why I've come to that conclusion. Firstly, formally, anything that can be computed so far, with possible exceptions like quantum computing, falls within the domain of that which can be computed by a Turing machine. But anything that can be computed by a Turing machine can also be calculated with the lambda calculus, right? So on a formal level, software and mathematics cover the same range of computational realms. Secondly, historically, software and mathematics have a very, very strong link. In fact, Alan Turing got the idea for the Turing machine out of the formalist mathematics program by David Hilbert, and also from Principia Mathematica, the logicist school, who sought to reduce proof of mathematical truths to small, discrete steps. Right, so you know what your starting point is. You have a series of steps, none of which can be argued with, to arrive at your conclusion. Which also gives rise to a kind of structural similarity between mathematics and software, namely that. And that's known as the Curry-Howard isomorphism. Basically, the tasks involved in doing mathematics and doing mathematical proofs are very similar to the tasks involved in coding. And I also think that it intuitively they're similar as well. Anyone want to... No? No challenge? Good. Okay. So as I said before, mathematics is not patentable and never has been. There's cases where they kind of mention offhand, or obiter as we say in the law, that mathematics isn't patentable. But there hasn't been any real investigation of why. But nonetheless, it's not patentable. So you would expect, with mathematics and software being the same, that software would also be not patentable. Now, just to give an illustration of how that... Yeah? it would be possible to make mathematics patentable, but since it's always been not patentable, you'd have to have a pretty good reason for changing the existing law, right? This is one case which kind of illustrates that lawyers don't really get the distinction between software and mathematics. In this case, this was the first of two software patent cases in Australia. And in that case, IBM had come up with a more efficient way of drawing a curve on a screen. Right? So you start with a set of control points. They applied two well-known mathematical algorithms to those control points to come up with a matrix representing the pixels on the screen. Right? So you start with numbers, you do something mathematical to them, and you end up with a matrix full of numbers. Mathematics? Well... No. What his honour said was, what is new here is the application of the selected mathematical methods to computers, and in particular the production of the desired curve by computer. This is said to involve steps which are foreign to the normal use of computers, and for that reason to be inventive. Right? So kind of what he's saying is that applying mathematics to something mathematical isn't necessarily mathematics and unpatentable because it's applied mathematics. Now that might ring true in other disciplines like physics, which use mathematics, right? But the use of mathematics doesn't prevent patenting. So it's a kind of curious argument that turns on itself. And that's just one example of many. There's lots of examples in the US case law, but that's my favourite because it's just so crazy. And so you have something irreconcilable, that which is patentable is also not patentable. Okay, the second thing which lawyers don't really seem to get is the relationship between software on the one hand and mental steps, or call it what you like, call it logic, call it reason. Just as mathematics has always been unpatentable, ideas have always been held to be not patentable. And in the recent case in the US of In re Bilski, the court pointed out that was because of the constitutional protection of freedom of thought. Patents were never supposed to extend to regulating what people think. So it would also seem you would think that, you know, the process of mechanised reasoning, which is what writing software is, you know, you're breaking down an algorithm into a series of small, discrete steps, would fall afoul or run afoul or at least raise concerns that maybe we need to tread carefully here. And, if you needed any proof of that, you only have to think about what Turing actually meant when he defined his Turing machine. He didn't have in mind some form of computer like the Colossus that he was working on at Bletchley Park. What he had in mind was a person sitting down with a pen and paper, following the rules set out for the system exactly, right? And it was only later that that came to be realised as a computer. You can see that kind of that reasoning, that mental process in action if you look at mathematics as well. And this is something from Principia Mathematica. I think this is about 500 pages in, where they are able to finally formally prove that 1 + 1 = 2. Right. The reason that it took them so long was that they wanted to be able to defend their starting points, and they wanted to be able to defend every single tiny little step that they took in expanding from their starting points to each proposition. Right. And they claimed to have been able to prove the truth of the whole of mathematics through pure logic and these small discrete steps, until Kurt Gödel got in the way. Okay. So the next thing which at least raises concerns is related to the last point, and it's the role of abstraction in software development. Now, courts certainly recognise that there's a need to have some kind of physical limit on patentable subject matter, and the reason that there is that physical limitation, like it has to involve some physical device or something, is that the physicality of an invention is a source of uncertainty, right? And overcoming that uncertainty is the sort of thing which needs to be protected against by a patent. Like, a patent gives you protection to try and commercialise an invention and gives the inventor the time to overcome the various uncertainties that might be involved in actually taking a prototype and getting it to market, right? And when you deal with physical devices, you've got all sorts of things like heat dissipation in computing is one obvious example. You know, if you're designing processes, then that's something physical that you need to worry about. In the US, the test that they set out in Bilski is that your invention needs to be tied in some way to a particular machine to be patentable, or it needs to transform some physical thing. Now, that is actually a very, very old thing. That test dates back to about 1876 in the US. But it had fallen out of favour, so Bilski's basically revived it. In Australia, we have a similar-ish test in that there's required to be some physical effect as a result of your patentable process, in the sense of a concrete effect or phenomenon or manifestation or transformation. Now, that's all well and good, and that should be the end of the story, right? Because that should be the end of the story. Because there's a physical device involved, right? But, as I mentioned before, the history of software suggests that abstractions come into play, right? When computers were first invented, it was all, you know, everything was done, had to be done in machine code. There's a very direct relationship with the hardware that you're running on, different processes, different instruction sets, and so on. And then the first abstraction was to abstract away to assembly language. And then further abstractions away to higher level languages, right? And to give a kind of example of the sort of things I do, I developed an online test product for Plone, you know, multiple choice quizzes, nothing too fancy. But if you look at the levels of abstraction between the code that I wrote and the hardware, there's a hell of a lot of abstraction there. And I don't think at any point I actually had to consider anything tied to the physicality of the machine that it was going to run on. I didn't have to worry about the architecture. Python's pretty much the same, no matter what sort of machine you've run it on, no matter what sort of operating system you run it on. So there's no physical limitation on the software that I wrote. Now, that might be entirely different in a different context. For example, if you're writing a device driver, you're very much concerned with the hardware. If you're working on the kernel, the hardware that it's supposed to run on is a big concern, right? But that's an issue of context, right? So context is very important, but context doesn't seem to be something which has been taken into account very much. And the abstraction problem's made even worse by the kind of top-down development process as well, where, you know, you start with a concept and you work towards the code. So if you kind of stack up the layers of abstraction on each other, you can see that because patent claims are generally written not as source code, you're talking about things which are written in natural language at very general levels, then patent claims kind of sit on the top of this pile of abstraction. So courts should be really careful to consider whether the physicality of the device actually does limit the invention in some way, or whether you've got something which is basically amounts to a patent on an idea. And I mentioned the context as well. So what's interesting to consider, and this is a particular concern that I have with the case law in Bilski, you know, Bilski might be cause to celebrate the fact that they've finally got software patent issues right. But in the past, the physicality of software has been held to be satisfied by the electrons which move around the computer when you run the software. Okay, that's I can't say I've ever had to worry about the path of an electron when I've been writing web-based content management system software. Satisfied by the floppy disk that you put the software on before you load it into the computer. And in the Australian case, satisfied in a smart card related invention, which was basically a patent on a particular way of structuring data, was held to have been satisfied by attaching a printer to the terminal which read the smart card, right? In the Australian context, that satisfied the physical effect test, right? So although we have a physical effect test, it's not consistent with what they're talking about in Bilski. Any questions on that? Okay, the next one is reuse. As I mentioned in the history of software, you necessarily depend on the work that's gone before you. If you had a look at the stack of abstractions, you know, when I'm writing a component for Plone, I'd depend on, you know, the Plone and Python and everything basically down the stack to be able to do the work. US patent 5960411. Anyone want to hazard a guess what that is? I thought I heard it there. No, it's not that. One click, yeah. Now, had Jeff Bezos and his team written themselves, you know, their website in machine code from nothing all the way to the point of implementing this one-click patent, well, then that would have been great. But I suspect that this number has more to do with the number of people that Jeff Bezos owes some gratitude for, to actually getting him to the point where he could implement cookies in the way that he did to get the patent. And that's, you know, the importance of reuse and the idea of incremental invention is a fairly well-worn path, so I don't really have a lot more to say about it. The next point is the beauty of code. I've used the term beauty to invoke to kind of tie in with mathematics, and I'll give you some examples of how beauty is considered to be important to mathematics. For example, Bertrand Russell said that mathematics, rightly viewed, possesses not only truth but supreme beauty, a beauty cold and austere, like that of sculpture, without appeal to any part of our weaker nature, without the gorgeous trappings of painting or music, yet sublimely pure and capable of a stern perfection such as only the greatest art can show. And Poincaré similarly said that a mathematician does not study pure mathematics because it's useful. He studies it because he delights in it, and he delights in it because it's beautiful. So understanding mathematics and getting to the truth of it is a source of beauty, and beauty is an incentive mechanism which operates in the context of mathematics, and it's one of the reasons that mathematics is considered a fine art rather than a useful art, to use the traditional distinction that they make in patent law, right? Patents are supposed to be available for things that are useful, and things that are beautiful or fine arts are supposed to be the realm of copyright. So, can software be beautiful? Well, I'll give my favourite example. I always like to... This one has everything as far as I'm concerned. not only does it have a visual aesthetic, is there anyone here who hasn't seen this before? Yeah, a couple? All right, well, this is what you get when you run it. It's not really only about the way it looks visually, it's just that it's so insanely cool that every time I look at it, I just think, how could you possibly do that? You know, where do you start? And there's a technical excellence there in being able to come up with that I just find astounding. So I have an emotional reaction to it in the same way that I might if I looked at a particularly fine piece of art over there on the wall. But the problem that comes up for lawyers, right, is they're distracted by the usefulness of software. So undoubtedly, most people's experience of software is not writing it or reading it, it's running it, right? And if you run it, well, then you generally need to run it for a purpose and it's probably going to be useful to you. They think of software as something that you buy in a box down the shops, you know, or maybe they're starting to change their minds. But so they're distracted by the usefulness of it and they think, well, okay, it fits with a patent regime. It doesn't really fit with a copyright regime. But the fact about software is not that it is really just beautiful. It is useful, and I wouldn't deny that it was useful. But really, the expressive nature of software has a lot more to do with the way it should be treated than is currently considered. And the best example that I could think of something which is considered to be a fine art, which is also useful, the only other example I could think of is architecture. Right? There's no doubt that buildings are useful, you know. We live in them, we use them. But architecture is protected by copyright. Individual things which go in houses might be considered to be patentable, but a house isn't something which you would get a patent on. I've really, the point here is that expression, another related point is that to people who haven't read code, they'd probably be surprised to find the number of comments that, you know, in code, that source code is for other people as well as for the machines that it runs on. And I was poking around trying to find some funny comments in code the other day, but most of them seem to have, you know, obscene language in them, so I thought I better not. On a related note, there's a distinction which courts try to make between code and data, which I don't think works really well. And again, back to this example, the code is the data as well. You know, like it's hard to make that clean distinction all the time between code and data, particularly looking at code as something for machines versus something that other people read. Right, so quite often people, you know, read source code to work out how something works, and you learn what good software is by reading good source code, you know, and seeing what hacky, terrible code is by writing it yourself. And I just wonder. I mean, I'd be open to see whether you would agree with me that writing better code is something which you already have an incentive to do because you want to be able to achieve that kind of technical excellence that I was talking about. Do you think expression's an incentive for you guys when you sit down and write code? Yep. Okay. Well, the final one I want to talk about is it's kind of a more subtle problem that lawyers have. And I'll read you the quote. I remember reading this quote in the first couple of weeks of my candidature for a PhD and thinking there was something wrong but not being 100% able to put my finger on what it was. So in this article I read by an Australian academic, certainly software developers are adamant that they have property rights in their software. Just ask one. All right? She obviously didn't ask this one. Well, he certainly is. Yes, yeah, certainly he's adamant. Maybe she should have left it at that. But what I would really like to know, I'll tell you essentially what I think the essence of property is. The essence of property is the right to exclude. So I have a question and a show of hands. Do you believe, hands up for yes, do you believe that you have the right to exclude others from the code that you write just by virtue of having written it? Should have. Do you believe you should have? Yeah? Okay. Yep.
But surely putting your software under the GPL versus public domain, you are excluding people's use of your software anyway. So you're saying that it's
yeah.
Your software,
well, that's one of the interesting things about it. I've taken the Creative Commons logos because they kind of break down the various things that might be involved in your, you know, you might, there's a kind of property way of thinking about things, you know. Could you be just as satisfied if anyone who used your code had to pay for it, right? Yeah, if you released it. That's something that doesn't necessarily involve a right to exclude. And for example, there's an academic called Jerome Reichman, who suggests that the best way to protect software is to have a kind of a government agency with which you can deposit code. Anyone can download and read it, but if they then use it, they have to pay a royalty, right? So that's just an example of something that's not property-based. Would that be something which you'd find acceptable, or is that not? Would that fall? Yeah. Yeah, so that's... Well, it is. Have you ever read a patent application? Yeah. Did you find it instructive? I once read the patent for .NET. I don't know what possessed me. I still don't know what .NET is. I mean, I didn't know what .NET was, and I was using VB.NET at the time. Cringe. But, you know, they're not instructive. They're not something that you think, oh, I need to find a new way to do this. I'll just go to the patent library and have a look through the applications. You know, I'll go to the USPTO website and use that. You know, the main reason I think is, you know, back to a point I said earlier about the source code. The source code's the best documentation that you can get for an invention. If people don't want to release their code, right, you don't need a property right to exclude others. Possessing it is enough, right? If you write it and you keep it on your computer and you don't give it to anyone, that's generally speaking enough. I suspect. Now I've just got one final quote that I couldn't do a talk on things lawyers don't understand about software without throwing this quote in. It was in a curiously pro-software patent article by a couple of academics that I'd never heard of in a law journal. The authors are grateful to Microsoft for supporting the research on which this paper is based. It wasn't until I got to the end notes and had a flick through that I kind of, light went on and thought, what's this about? That's really all I wanted to get through, but, you know, I know software patents are a hot issue, so I'm sure that you've all got things that you want to ask or things that you want to say. So there's plenty of time left. Take the floor, go for it. Any questions?
Has anyone here received the DMCA notice for payment for a deal with that?
Not seeing any responses. Hey? Yeah, okay. The question was, has anyone received a DMCA notice for a patent when they've been working on, for a project they've been working on? No? Okay. Yeah?
I'm interested in the interaction between like copyright law and patent
and that would have been enough, but it's been the, does the interaction of papers coming in diminish the rights of software from a copyright point of view as a written word? Or is it just ancillary and they're trying to add that on top?
You know, the overlap of different different intellectual property regimes is a really interesting area, because often they do overlap like that. But that's another interesting thing that it's not really considered, you know. I think judges don't really consider what the impact of, say, having the copyright means when they're considering whether software should be patentable as well. I mean, software was clearly copyrighted to begin with, and that was less objectionable. Yeah. Well, there's been a flow-on effect, I think, from software becoming patentable. I don't know if you're familiar with the storyline patents that went through, right? A budding and enterprising young patent attorney, on seeing that software and then business methods had become patentable, decided that maybe there should be protection for other things which are copyrighted. So he tried to get protection on a plot for a movie, and it was successfully granted. I believe it was revoked not too long ago. Or I believe that the Bilski test will wipe it out. But I think that when you take something which has previously been copyrighted and then you say, yes, it can also be patented, well, then that does disrupt the balance in the copyright regime as well as the patent regime, right? But that's not something which is... The interaction of them hasn't been considered very well as well. There's an interesting kind of similarity when copyright overlaps with trademark, right? So you get copyright protection, say, for, I don't know, Mickey Mouse for, you know, more and more and more and more time. When the copyright runs out, you can expect Disney to then say, well, people identify Mickey Mouse with us. So if they see Mickey Mouse in something, they're going to think that's got something to do with us. That's the role that a trademark has. So now we've got a common law trademark as well. Right, so there's all sorts of interactions between the different regimes, but generally they tend to treat them all as silos that don't have any interaction. And that's why software is so difficult. It's expressive, as I said. It fits. Source code is a literary work of some kind. It's definitely written in a language. Languages have all the expressive attributes that the English language does. But it is useful, so it has that kind of seeming fit with the patent regime as well. And so really I think the best way to protect it would probably be for some sort of sui generis regime. Because if you leave software to just copyright alone, there's always going to be that kind of pressure on it to say, well, it doesn't protect against independent imitation. You know, it doesn't protect against functional equivalence. So people are going to be crying that, you know, copyright doesn't do everything that it needs to do to protect software. So I think the only real solution will be when it's removed from copyright and patent and put in a unique regime, right, which fits things that don't fit in the traditional categories. But where that would leave open source licensing, I'm not sure. That's a difficult question in itself, because, you know, open source depends on copyright at the present time. But, you know, maybe that's something that could be taken into account in asking for this kind of change. Well, you know, if we're disclosing the source code, we're disclosing the product anyway. Maybe we waive the right to royalties so long as, you know, there's still room for licensing in a different regime, but it's part of the balance that needs to be considered. Sorry, yeah, with the glasses. Well, one of the motivations for this talk was really that I think these are things that lawyers don't understand. So part of the solution, I think, is to help the legal fraternity understand the things that they're getting wrong. You know, I think maybe if they could understand that software is different because it's so abstract, and there really is a cause for concern that, you know, possibly patenting ideas. And bringing the experience to bear in kind of helping the legal fraternity get it right, rather than warring with them or assuming that they're just idiots, or that lobbying through Parliament's the only way to go. which is kind of a pragmatic thing based on, well, they have a lack of understanding. Let's see if we can improve things through education. Yeah. Unknowing infringement, yeah. Well, basically that's the reason why unknowingly infringing a patent still gives rise to liability is that you're awarding a monopoly to the patent holder, and so intention isn't really relevant. It's relevant in the US for damages purposes, but if you're truly going to protect someone's invention, then you have to protect them against anyone who comes up with something similar. Yeah, if you're giving them a monopoly, you can't say you've got a monopoly unless someone independently comes up with the same thing, because that sort of encourages gaming of the system. You know, there would be ways to gently push, you know, developers in a slightly different company, or you know, in a slightly different location, clean room sort of thing. There'd be a way to push them to come up with a similar invention without actually them having any knowledge that's what they were doing. Yeah. Well, I read everything that I could get my hands on, and say from the State Street case, following the footnotes and all the references all the way back to the 1800s, all the important ones. You know, there's a lot. Hundreds, definitely hundreds that make it to court. In Australia, a lot less, I think. You know, there's only been two decided software patent cases, and none of them were by the highest court anyway. Well, in the IBM case, they said that, if it produces a useful effect, then it's patentable. Right? And then that was confirmed in the subsequent case. Yeah. Well, if you put yourself in the position of someone who's threatened with patent litigation, the costs are enormous, you know. So it's a very good bluff. If you've got a validly issued patent, there's a lot to be said for it, whether it's got any value or not. You know, you've either got to step up and challenge the patent, in which case, if you're unsuccessful, you've got to pay the costs of the other party. And the other party, if they've gone out and they're able to afford to buy a patent in the first place, they've probably got the money to put on a good legal team, you know. So it could cost you $1 million if you lose. And there's not a lot of people who would have $1 million or would be so prepared to actually stand up and fight a patent like that. Yeah. Yep.
So all the things you've talked about today seem to be mostly related to patents.
Yeah.
Presuming you consider that to be the biggest problem with legalities of software, or do you consider other issues
to be? Well, I kind of touched on the effect of you know, of not understanding software and copyright, in that, you know, it doesn't quite protect the use. It doesn't protect against independent imitation. But patent law is certainly my bias, but I think it's the most interesting area. I've read cases on copyright of software, and it almost seems to me that courts considering copyright seem to do a better job of engaging with the issues. Like the top-down development model is something that was discussed in Computer Associates and Altai. And they seem to be switched on, but I'm not quite sure why there isn't that same engagement in patent law, and I suspect that it's just not litigated as much, or that there's something about the way the patent law is structured that doesn't require them to engage with the kind of wider non-economic or non-legal issues. Tend to take a very narrow focus on a set of legal issues, legal interpretations, and the previous case law, and a bit of economics. But they don't really consider what the social impact of awarding a patent is. Well, they don't consider the ethics of a patent in a particular area to any real extent. And I don't know if that's just the tradition of patent law, to say, well, you know, if you've got ethical and social issues, well, then they can be resolved by legislation elsewhere. Okay. Sorry, I missed your question a few times.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I know you were talking about the difference between expressive and functionality, and that was always really source code and the actual running program.
Yeah.
Wouldn't a possible solution then maybe be to allow copyright or patent allow people to say, well, okay, my software's either under copyright as a functional thing,
yep,
or there's patented source code, but make people like, could choose one or the other. Because,
yeah,
as you were saying, different people want different protections.
It would be possible. I don't think that it necessarily removed the source of the problem. I mean, you've got to look at who's doing most of the software patenting, and most of it's big firms doing it for defensive purposes or small troll companies, you know, to make money. And they're still going to continue to go for the patents, and they don't really care about the copyright so much. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, up the back here? Yeah. Yeah.
By licensing or by preventing other people to do it.
It's, yep.
The preventing is me, not the original. It's not the original.
Yeah, yeah. It has that social purpose.
With software at the moment, the rate of development and improvements is so fast that the time to market is actually key. If you distract yourself with patenting, you actually using funding and time in the wrong direction rather than getting to market, if you can afford it at all.
Yeah.
So your time to market is really fast. And also, patents, there's also improved mousetraps. The original patent system doesn't deny you from building that mousetrap, but just that particular mousetrap design that was patented. With software, same thing. It shouldn't actually remove the opportunity to improve the technology in the second part of software. It just moves much faster. So just having a copyright allows you to get to market and allows you to be bidding. If you have source code that is GPL, for instance, getting your code ripped and abused in a certain way, but it doesn't prevent the improvement. The patents do prevent the movement, particularly because, of course, the timeline of the patent is much too large. Now, Australia has a 5 or 6 year innovation patent.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an attempt to mitigate that. That's still before us. The whole patent thing on software just doesn't work in the software sphere.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It just doesn't work for me as a business. Economically, when I really think about it, it just distracts from what I want to do, which is...
Yeah, which is another point.
Make money with it and then move on to the next thing.
Well, that's exactly right. You said at the outset that the purpose of having a patent is to guarantee a return. Yeah. Well, there's other ways to guarantee returns that don't even have to involve property rights. That's the kind of point that I was trying to get. If you start with that as your goal, to guarantee a return, then, yeah, something which gives you maybe a small standardised royalty for people who use your software further down the track, and maybe even people who improve on your original invention should have to pay you some form of royalty. Well, then that's probably more encouragement, because there's not all the administrative crap involved that there is in getting a patent, and the expense and the timelines and that sort of thing. Yeah?
How much in the patent area is the sort of the romantic garden shed sort of developer thing under the current regime? So there's a scare if they do a major change, their meeting group comes up with a, you know, the next one patent in my house, I've got enough money to patent it, but I haven't got enough money to create a joint corporation.
Yeah. It's a well-worn path of rhetoric, really. If you have a look at who's actually doing the patenting, There was a study by, I think it's Besson and Hunt in the US. They had a look at the data of what firms were patenting and whether firms who were patenting a lot were spending more on R&D and those sorts of things. And basically they found it's mostly big firms. They're mostly doing it for defensive purposes, and there's a correlation between the number of patents increasing and a drop-off in R&D spending. Right. So basically their conclusion was, you know, that that there's not that incentive in the software industry for patents at all, which I'm sure doesn't surprise anyone here.
I was wondering what your view was on how some of the big companies like Microsoft and so on are developing sort of patent batches so they can defend themselves against other companies who have patents they may be infringing on, sort of a mad dog.
Yeah, that's the Cold War scenario where big companies buy lots of patents, not really to enforce them, but as a backup plan. So if I come to you and say, well, you're infringing on one of my patents, and say, well, you're probably infringing on one of my 100,000, let's do a licensing deal. It doesn't cost them anything. Yeah, so it's a form of insurance, mostly, and that's the way that, that software patents are mostly being used. Yeah, well, that's it. Trolls don't have any assets. They don't care if they lose. They just want the licensing fee. So that strategy doesn't work against them at all. Yeah. Yep.
So one thing you might want to clarify, somebody asked what it is you can do, you might want to mention defensive publications, you know, getting your source code out there so that those ideas can't be patented. And also somebody mentioned about patenting their source code, and source code can't be patented, you might want to clarify that.
Yeah, that's true. Source code can't be patented. What you do is you get a patent attorney to draft a description of your invention in patent speak, which is as broad as you can possibly get, and so not very instructive usually. And sorry, what was the first part of it?
You might want to mention defensive publications.
Yeah, defensive publications. Right. If you are you familiar with the SCO litigation? I'd imagine that most people are. Yeah. Okay. one of the best things that I saw in the entire SCO debacle was when Dale McBride finally put up and said, look, here's some infringing code in the kernel. And this, you know, within a day, people were actually able to find it and go through the version control for that particular set of code and say, well, actually, it was contributed by X here and it was blah, 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 and could basically defeat the code. So on that basis, you know, if you publish your code before the date of application of a patent, you know, well, then that becomes prior art and that becomes a weapon for defeating a badly issued patent. So open source is also good for that purpose. But further, if you just, you know, if you're writing code and you just want to publish it, you don't necessarily need to open source license it. You could do a defensive publication and just get your code out there. Up to you. Depends on your business model, I guess. Yeah.
not trying to
Yeah, so the question is, do lawyers get mathematics? Yeah, so can you hinge your arguments on the unpatentability of mathematics? Well, like I said before, there was a case in 2007 about the patentability of a mathematical innovation, and counsel on neither side, you know, in the UK could find any precedent, you know, any case where the idea that mathematics wasn't patentable first came into being. So there is a danger there. There is a danger that they don't get mathematics, and that the reverse of what I'm saying will happen is that because software's become patentable and because courts now talk about mathematical algorithms as being the same as software in a sense, that they won't understand any reasons for keeping mathematics free anymore. So one of the things that I've done in my thesis is to actually have a look at the philosophy of mathematics and try and answer the question of what mathematics is, and see if there's anything about mathematics any explanation that makes it clear why it is that mathematics shouldn't be patentable. And what I've come up with was the expressive nature of it and the importance of beauty and the importance of achieving truth makes it expressive and makes it something which isn't really suited to patent protection. But it is a danger. It's a definite danger. Yep. That's a very good question. I remember when I did my first computer science programming course at uni, the tutor said in an offhand manner, you need to choose between Vi and Emacs. And somehow I ended up using Vi, and I've regretted it ever since. But only because I just get lost, you know. I forget to type the colon before I type Q, and then it goes into some recording mode, and I can't remember how to get out of it and stuff like that. But I can't remember the key bindings for Emacs. So I have actually started using Aquamax Emacs, which has a lot of the standard Apple key bindings. So started to wet my feet a bit, but I'm still a Vi user. I'm sorry to the Vi users out there. I'm sure that it has advantages that I just plainly don't understand. One more question? Yeah.
There's been some talk every now and then, perhaps every now and then, about the whole first to file versus first to protected. Would you be able to summarise that? Because I've tried reading about it and I've been confused about the pros and cons of why, but it seems that the US has one system and everyone else has another.
Yeah, I think it's probably for historical reasons. It is strange, but in the US they've always had a first to file, so it doesn't matter who actually came up with the invention first. The first person to get their patent application in to the patent office in the US will be the one who deserves patent protection. So if you say you came up with the idea 3 days before, but you got your patent in 3 days later, then the other party will then, you know, they filed first, they'll get the invention. I can't say that I really understand the policy reason for it, particularly when you look at the way they judge whether a patent is novel or not. And if you're going to say, well, the prior art on that date was this, I guess it has to be a published document. No. Yeah, it doesn't really make sense to me. First to invent makes more sense, because then you can kind of say, well, we came up with it on this date. And yeah. Yeah, but it still leaves them out of step with the rest of the world. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. So there are policy reasons which other people could give you, but I couldn't. No, I tend to stick mostly to patentable subject matter, which, you know, it's amazing that you can spend 4 or 5 years on just one aspect of patent law, but... Yeah. Okay, thanks very much.